Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/watsonassistant.
This is DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg.
I mean, there's no easy way to start the show today. It's awful what's going on in this country. It's very uncomfortable. It's very upsetting. We discussed it last week. It, you know, became even more so of a story and a bigger issue this weekend. And we're here Monday morning, Chris, and it's horrible and it's scary and it's concerning and it's all the adjectives you can throw the way of where we are in this country and in this world right now.
Yeah, Dave, it's scary right now where we're at as a country and the state of affairs as it pertains to race relations. And you saw a lot of the protests this weekend. You also saw some rioting this weekend and just people expressing a level of outrage because of what's been going on and the police brutality that has led to the murders of unarmed black Americans and most recently George Floyd. I think we've gotten to a tipping point where people are just tired of it. People are frustrated, particularly black Americans. We're not being seen. We want our voices to be heard, and it's just not happening. And so after you've tried to go through certain channels, you've tried to do nonviolent protests, you've tried to, you know, exercise your right to vote, and it still feels like you're not being heard, I think this is the result of that, what we saw this weekend. I'm not condoning violence by any means, but I do understand the frustrations of people that have been marginalized for decades in this country. And so I think we're at a point now where you're starting to see those frustrations boil over. It's ugly. It's uncomfortable. But Dave, in order to fix racism, in order to effectively combat it, we've got to have some uncomfortable conversations. It's not going to feel good. And so I think that we have to wrap our minds around that in order to be able to try to chart a path forward together.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And Rick, we say good morning to you. And you know, you have little kids, and I have little kids, and I'm sure it's a conversation you had to have with them over the course of the weekend. And I mean, I don't know what else to say, but it stinks where we are right now. It just stinks.
No, I'm sad, Dave. I mean, this whole weekend, and we spoke about this, you know, on Friday, and, you know, I had that conversation with Milo. I mean, we didn't get into too much depth. He's only 5 years old, but I mean, to have him, you know, to have him watching the TV and see what he saw and ask me, you know, why, and me as a dad not be able to really, you know, truly explain it to him because it's not an experience that I've gone through. It makes me sad, man, with what's going on in the world. I mean, I feel like the world is spinning out of control and I don't know how to make it stop or when this is going to stop. I think to Chris's point and the conversations that we have to have, it's why I love having the opportunity to do this show because, you know, having someone like Chris on this show who is a successful black man who's, you know, gone through some of this stuff and lived this, I think it's up to us to have those uncomfortable conversations. And I think the most important thing is that, you know, this can't be a conversation that we have now and just stops. Mm-hmm. I think the longevity of this conversation is the most important. I mean, we talked about this for a while with the whole Colin Kaepernick thing, and then, you know, those conversations stopped, and they can't stop because, I mean, it's 2020, and this is still a huge problem. And, you know, I don't think, you know, Dave and I as white men who haven't gone through these experiences and people, you know, that are white that haven't gone through these experiences, you can't just, you know, use ignorance as an excuse or just, you know, lack of experience as an excuse. You got to take the time now to listen. And that's one of the things that frustrates me the most about where we're at as a society is people aren't willing to listen. They just want to talk at you. You can't have a conversation if you're not willing to listen. And now's the time for us that haven't had these experiences to listen, to truly listen and try to find a way to do whatever we can. And that doesn't mean that, you know, we're going to sit here on the radio for 3 hours and find a solution to the problem because that's not going to happen. It hasn't happened yet. I mean, the years and years and years of this happening, that hasn't happened, but you know, it's on us to have the conversation and then do what you can in your own circle to try to have an effect, you know, influence the circle of people that you know. And that can be a good first step.
You're absolutely right, Rick. I think it starts with doing small things, having conversation, having dialogue, and trying to gain some insights about what the issues are. Because everybody talks about institutional racism, but people really don't understand how it manifests itself. And so actually talk to black and brown people and get an idea of what their day-to-day experiences are. You know what I'm saying? Understand the issues. Educate yourself. You said it. Ignorance is not an excuse anymore. Everybody is seeing the video clips time after time, year after year, of unarmed black people being killed at the hands of police. At some point, it has to stop. It's not like you don't know what's going on. Colin Kaepernick made sure that a few years back, you knew what was going on. You knew why he was taking a knee. And yet everybody wanted to hijack the message that Colin Kaepernick said. They wanted to make it about the flag. They wanted to make it about the military. And what he was talking about was a system that continued to show black Americans that their lives aren't valued the same way as other Americans. And that's by the police setting that example, by killing unarmed black Americans. I'm not going to sit here and bash the police because all the police aren't bad. But the reality is, when you see those images, when you see those examples of law enforcement doing that to black Americans, that shows you the value of black lives in this country. And it's unfortunate. And then when you see a lot of athletes take the stance that they've taken, I just mentioned Colin Kaepernick, but also seeing what Jaylen Brown did down in Atlanta with Malcolm Brogdon and Justin Anderson, or Udonis Haslem down in Miami. Like those guys joining those protests and trying to put words to the frustrations that the people are going through. Like I think this is an example of what it looks like when people don't feel seen and don't feel heard. And we've got to get to the point in this country where we're willing to do that and not be defensive on the other side. We're not asking for anything that other races and ethnicities don't ask for in this country. We're not. We just want to be treated fairly by the police and everybody else in America.
It's well said. Now, we spoke about this last week after the Last Dance documentary, guys, that Michael Jordan never says anything. And he finally did. And let me read you a couple of quotes of what Michael said. He said, "I'm deeply saddened, truly pained, and plain angry. I stand with those who are calling out the ingrained racism and violence toward people of color in our country. We have had enough. I don't have the answers, but our collective voices show strength and the inability to be divided by others. We must listen to each other, show compassion, empathy, never turn our backs on senseless brutality. We need to continue peaceful expressions against injustice and demand accountability. Our unified voice needs to put pressure on our leaders to change our laws, or else we need to use our vote to create systemic change. Every one of us needs to be part of the solution, and we must work together to ensure justice for all." Chris, and I think it's important that this is not a section of society that needs to make the change. This is the entirety of people that needs to stand up and make a change here.
Dave, it's going to take all of us. I mean, it's not one segment of the population that's going to lead to the widespread change that we need in this country when it comes to racism. Like, it takes all of us, and it starts with education. We can't afford to continue to be ignorant, and we can't afford to not have more urgency when attacking this problem. People are dying. And at this point, when you start talking about lives being lost senselessly, I think everybody recognizes that something has to be done, but people don't necessarily know where to start. And that's why I'm glad that Rick brought it up. It starts with your circle, your sphere of influence, doing what you can to try to change hearts and minds. This is not a time where we need to retreat to our separate corners. This is a time where we need to come together. And that was one of the encouraging things that I saw this weekend. It wasn't just black people protesting in cities across America. It was everyone. And so I think that we have to recognize that this is not the time where somebody can afford to be neutral. This is the time for all of us to stand up and be anti-racist. I would love it.
To do. You have to be able to do that. You have to be able to. You say,
well, how about,
Dave, you say that you would have to be able to do that, but I mean, you see it on social media. There are some people that choose to focus on the riots and the protests, and they talk more about that than they do about the murder of George Floyd. And that's unfortunate, because I think that's a part of the problem. When you don't recognize why those frustrations are boiling over and manifesting themselves the way that they are, that just continues to perpetuate the fear and the feelings that Black Americans have that we're not being heard. Something about that really has to change.
How about be pro-humanity? I mean, how about just be a human being? I mean, that's, you know, having watched that video a couple different times and being sick to my stomach every time I watch that video. I mean, it's disregarding human life. I mean, that's what that video is. I mean, that's murder. You witness murder. And I mean, it's sad that it took, you know, that video with, you know, everything that we've talked about, having experiences with Chris and, you know, how frustrated Chris has been, since, you know, we've been doing the show, listening to some of that stuff, you know, him and Ray Santiago and how frustrated they get, that it takes a video like this where you see somebody murdered, where, you know, for now all of a sudden people to feel like they should speak out. You can't be silent anymore. I mean, being silent is being complicit. You need to speak out. And you need to support, because I mean, as a country, we're so divided right now, man. I mean, especially now with the pandemic and everyone's social distancing and everything else, we got to come together and heal. We have to, because this is getting out of control. It really is. And you know, I opened the show by saying I'm sad. I am. I mean, I am sad.
I think we all are
for where we are as a country. I mean, we tout ourselves as the greatest country in the world, and right now it doesn't feel that way. It feels like we've never been more divided as a country.
You're 100% right. Now, Louis Riddick, who I think we all respect, obviously NFL analyst, but so much more, spoke earlier today about it. It just can't be, and like we said on this show, it just can't be the minorities speaking out on this.
It needs to be emphasized. It can't just be us minorities or African Americans. It has to be all people. And the white athletes who are now stepping up need to continue to step up and need to continue to voice the fact that this cannot be normalized. The kind of things that you're seeing on TV right now, as far as, you know, Black men being killed in the streets, cannot be normalized. And in a sense, it is being normalized, because it is then just moved on, and then it's just on to whatever the next thing that is happening in society.
And that's Louis Riddick, and he's right, Chris.
Yeah, Dave, I mean, Black Americans are tired of hashtags and t-shirts. We're over it. Like, there are people that are losing their lives, and Dave, it's happening all over the country. I mean, we're talking about what's happening in Minnesota, but it's happened before in Louisiana. It's happened in South Carolina. It's happened in Chicago. Like, it just keeps on happening. But it only happens to one group of people. It only happens to one group of people, and that's the part of it that I don't understand. So I guess when we start talking about these conversations and you're speaking on how it fades away over time. I guess it fades away because people would rather talk about something else. They'd rather not deal with the ugly realities that a lot of Black Americans. Well, think about it. If they're uncomfortable talking about it, how uncomfortable are we going about our day-to-day lives not knowing if we're going to make it back home alive?
I'll tell you what.
How uncomfortable is that reality?
I can't imagine. I have no idea what it must feel like.
But that's my point, Dave. Something about it has to change. Our reality hasn't changed. So in order to get things to move in the right direction, we have to have these conversations. People have to be willing to come outside of their comfort zone, because that's the only way anything is going to get done. We need this is the time where Black Americans need allies. I've got a friend that works for Turner Sports and doing some of their NBA content. His name is Ro Parrish. He put something out there on Twitter this weekend. Ro said, imagine if America loved Black Americans the way they love Black culture, the way they love our athleticism, the way they love our sense of style and fashion, the way they love our language, our speech. Imagine if America loved us as much as they love our culture. I don't understand it, Dave. I can't wrap my mind around it. This has been going on since before I was born. And the thought was, even when I was a kid, that things are moving in the right direction. We've come so far since my parents were kids. And my parents were excited about what my future would be, the things that I wouldn't have to deal with. And Dave, I want to believe that things are better and things are going to continue to get better, but Dave, it just feels like it's getting worse.
Yeah, I don't even know what to tell you.
And the reality is we don't know if it's worse or not. We're just actually having the opportunity to see it because of technology. But Dave, it doesn't feel like it's moving in the right direction. And that's why I say we all have to have more urgency in terms of addressing racism. You can no longer afford to be silent.
I think the other thing too, we have to have more empathy. I mean, we do. I mean, we have to have more empathy, and we can't. I mean, I think there's too many people that live their lives just with, you know, through stereotypes and not really taking the time to get to understand people in general. And I think we're fortunate as, you know, as athletes that play team sports. I mean, I've been able to have, you know, experiences with, you know, people of different color, different religious beliefs, different backgrounds. So I've had an opportunity. I mean, those are my brothers, right? Like, I mean, you're in a locker room. Those guys you go to battle with every single day. You go through, you know, two-a-days and everything else. They become your family. They become your brothers. And, you know, you get an opportunity to share experiences, to get to know them, who they are as people, right? That's not the case with a lot of people. You know, where you, depending on where, I mean, Carson Wentz had the tweet where he grew up. You know, there's not many, you know, black or brown people where he's from. But because, you know, of the sport he plays, I mean, he's had the opportunity to get to know a lot of, you know, African American men or guys from different, you know, backgrounds and upbringings and everything else. So he has more of an idea what they go through. Us doing the show with Chris every day. You know, Chris is, you know, having a chance to meet his parents and his family, like you know, you get to learn about people. You can't just, you know, fear what you don't know or fear what you don't understand. You got to take the time to learn, to listen and understand the different people around you. Because we're not all the same. Not every white person's the same.
No, and that's fine.
But it's so lazy. It's just lazy. It drives me crazy because it's laziness. You're just going to live your life just, you know, stereotyping everybody instead of just taking the opportunity to get to know people. Because it's not, I mean, the world we live in now, it's not, everything isn't, you know, black and white or Republican or Democrat. It's not that simple. It's not that easy. But we get stuck where it's either one side or the other. I mean, let's come to, you know, realize that it's usually somewhere in the middle. There's a middle ground.
Yeah, but with this issue, there is no middle ground. With racism, there is no middle ground. You're absolutely right in terms of people being dug in on their sides of the aisle in the political spectrum. But with this issue of race, this is not something that needs to be politicized. This is an American issue. And Rick, you said this a few years ago. And I think Alan Hahn was on the show at the time. But when you said this, it resonated with me. You said America is a bad team. We don't work together. We don't care enough about one another in order for us to accomplish the ultimate goal, which is win. Everybody wants a better future for their family. Everybody wants security. Everybody wants to feel safe. Everybody wants to feel like their voice is heard and that they're seen. That's what everybody wants. But when you have certain Americans that don't have that reality, I think it's the duty of all Americans to fight to make sure that those Americans that have been marginalized are seen, that they are heard, that they are made to feel safe, that they are valued as contributing members of our society. That's all of our duty as Americans. Everybody wants to talk about being a patriot and how much they love this country, how much they love the flag. Well, that is a part of your duty as a patriot. That is a part of your duty if you love the flag. To make sure the ideals, the morals and values of this country are upheld. And that includes treating black Americans with the dignity and respect that we deserved, the dignity and the respect that you demand. That's it.
You know,
it's that simple.
Chris, you know what? I guess what I meant, and maybe I didn't do a good enough job explaining it. I just think as far as, you know, us having this conversation, right? Me, you, and Dave. Like this is for us. I mean, this is essentially an inner circle, right? Me, you, mm-hmm. Dave, the Rays, so we can have this conversation. And you know, me as a white guy that hasn't shared your same experiences, I don't feel intimidated, right? Because I know you, and we can go back and forth. We can agree and disagree.
Yes.
And you know, we'll come to some kind of, you know, agreement, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there'll be times when we have these conversations. I go back to when we're having the Colin Kaepernick conversation, and this is why I love you and I have so much respect for you, because my point was, you don't just see, like, we're all in the same thing. I mean, and I said this at the time, if you don't agree with why Colin Kaepernick is taking a knee, then I can't help you, right? I can't. Because if you don't agree with that, then we have bigger problems, right?
Mm-hmm.
But people would call in, and again, going back to how smart you are and how much I love you, is that there'll be times where you disagree and you'll make a point. And then to hear, you know, the vitriol towards you because you disagreed, that for me is, I mean, that's you, you know, a black man that's gone through those experiences with mm-hmm. an informed, educated opinion, and people just attacked you. So for me as a white guy, not having that, you know, had those experiences, the conversation sometimes gets a little intimidating. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So it's, you know, it becomes a little tough in that regard. You know what I'm saying?
No, I get that it becomes tough, but we have to continue to fight. And the one thing that I will say when it comes to being anti-racist and fighting institutional racism and systemic oppression in this country is when you are fighting, when you are having those conversations, you're on the side of righteousness, Rick. Like, this is the right thing to do. Everybody knows it. That's why you're seeing the reaction around the country. This is not something that we're not aware of. Now, people can choose to ignore the reality of it. They can choose to ignore the issues that the black community is dealing with. But they know that it's wrong. There's no way you can look at that George Floyd video and not say that that's wrong. Yet you have some Americans that don't want to focus on that. Why is that?
I don't have a good answer. I wish I had a better answer for you. I don't know.
There is no good answer. That's the answer. That is the answer. Because there can't be an answer.
Because nothing you could explain to me. If you watch that video and weren't sick to your stomach watching it,
yep.
I don't even know if I could have a conversation with you.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So, and I don't... It's just we're at a point now, and it, I don't want to say frustrates me. I mean, but it does. I mean, it aggravates me a little bit. That I mean, you know, Colin Kaepernick did what he did, and you know, he paid the price. He's not playing in the NFL and everything else. And you know, he had some missteps along the way. And people, I mean, hijacked the message and everything else. But I mean, where was all the support when Colin Kaepernick was doing what he was doing? You know what I'm saying? Like, where was the support from? How many times did we say, you know, if this was, you know, Aaron Rodgers that took a knee, or, you know what I'm saying? Would it be different? It probably would have been different, because there's no way. I mean, what are you going to do to a quarterback that guy's not going anywhere? But now all of a sudden, I mean, I guess it's a good thing because everyone is, you know, you've seen more and more white athletes step up, but I don't know. This can't be something that just in the moment, because it was so blatant, is a topic of conversation that then goes away. This has to be something that we
can
talk about.
Because if this goes away, then we're just going to repeat it again. There has to be change that happens moving forward here. And I like, Chris, the fact, and we'll continue the conversation throughout the show today. It won't be the basis of the show, but, you know, in and out it will be. And that is, you've had a lot of athletes of all colors stand up and speak out over the last 48 to 72 hours.
No, you have, Dave, and that's great to see. And we know how big sports can be in terms of
it's huge
being an agent for change in this country, right? We've seen it before. I mean, going back to Jesse Owens and some of the, you know, Jackie Robinson and breaking the color barrier in America's pastime baseball, like just all of the different Jim Brown, Muhammad Ali, the list goes on and on. I mean, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar wrote an op-ed piece in the LA Times this weekend talking about the protests and the murder of George Floyd. So we know that athletes who have a huge platform have an opportunity to sway hearts and minds and to, you know, help Americans formulate their opinions around issues of social justice. So we know that that can be can be a huge influence. The one thing I will say, it was encouraging. I mean, hearing about Jaylen Brown driving over 10 hours down to Atlanta to lead the protest, like that is the athlete recognizing their responsibility, having some awareness of the situation and knowing that they have something to add in order to change the conversations that we're having about race relations and systemic oppression. So I applaud those guys, and I continue to encourage all the athletes to do that, not just black athletes, but all athletes to do that, Dave.
Absolutely.
Because those are individuals that we tout as heroes, and people will be willing to listen to them, and sometimes people won't. And there are going to be people that are turned off by it. There are going to be people that don't approve of it. But, Dave, Colin Kaepernick wasn't a popular protest, but neither was Martin Luther King. That wasn't a popular protest. There wasn't widespread support by all Americans. He was vilified as well. It wasn't until he died that we appreciated what he stood for. The same thing can be said about Muhammad Ali. So it's
people detested Muhammad Ali. A lot of people.
But Dave, I guess that's my point. It's not as if we don't know that there is going to be some criticism with whatever format of protest that we choose. Quite frankly, to me, there is no right way to protest, because you're protesting a system of oppression. You're protesting being brutalized and murdered by law enforcement. When it's something that has to do with your life being on the line, I don't think you can say there's a wrong way to do that. Now, you wish that it wouldn't have to resort in violence and people being hurt. But the reality is, we wouldn't be to this point unless the lives of black and brown people in this country weren't constantly being compromised by the people that are charged to protect us.
Of course, we will get to the calls as the show moves forward today. 800-919-3776. And listen, let's be honest, it is very sensitive topics, and we're going to do our best to discuss it and be as respectful as humanly possible. Let's bring in, I mean, he is just, you know, the salt of the earth, one of our favorites, and that, of course, is Buster Olney. Good morning, Buster. How are you?
Good morning, guys. And Chris, I've heard what you said. I am so with you on the whole point of it's just incomprehensible. It's hard to understand. And I was thinking about, as you were talking, you know, one of the most moving things, interviews that I ever saw, was done on a 30 for 30 on the Ernie and Bernie show, and it was an interview with Bernard King, and you know, this is an interview done when he was an adult, and I'm guessing probably in his mid-40s, and has how he described an incident in 1978, how he was being beaten by a cop in Knoxville. Tears began to come down his eyes, and he wasn't loudly weeping, but as he described as an adult of what happened to him when he was 20 or 21, he just said, "I just didn't understand. Like, that didn't make any sense." And that you know, absolutely resonated for me. As they say, that was 1978. I grew up in Vermont, but I went to Vanderbilt in Nashville in the fall of 82, and I was shocked by things that I saw and things that I heard. I'll never forget in that my freshman year. You know, that was the year that Phi Slamma Jamma, University of Houston, played the NC State in the final. And I remember asking one of my dorm mates, who I, you know, at that point, he was my best friend up until that moment. I said, "Hey, who are you rooting for?" He goes, "Oh, I'm rooting for NC State." And I asked why, and he goes, "Well, Houston's a bunch of fill in the blank." And I was just, like, shocked by that. And that perspective, because when you really think about it, when you really think about, you know, the difference in race. You know, my next-door neighbor, Joe DiMarzo, he's of Italian descent. He's got a darker complexion than me. And why is that? Because his ancestors back in the day, they were closer to the equator and had more exposure to the sun than my ancestors did, from Ireland and England. And the idea that I would judge him, or anybody would judge him any differently than they would me, based on my complexion, I don't get that. I don't get why anyone, you know, that George Floyd, Chris, or you, or me, or Joe DiMarzo would be judged on the basis of our complexion, just based on where ancestors were? How stupid is that? And how colossally awful is that? And that's why I don't understand. like you, Chris.
Buster, I'm with you. It's ignorant, but the reality is that there are a lot of people today that are unwilling to acknowledge that America has a race problem. Even since we've come on the airwaves, we have fans that listen to us every single day that tweet at us on social media, and they want to throw out statistics and other things of that nature, and they don't want to acknowledge that America has a racism problem. And until everybody is willing to acknowledge that, we're not going to be able to move forward in this country. Things are not going to be able to get better. And so that's one of the things to me that was encouraging about this weekend. You saw athletes, you saw a lot of people across the spectrum decided they were going to come out in protest of what took place in Minnesota on Memorial Day. So I want to try to be encouraged by the fact that that did happen this weekend, Buster. Clearly, you don't condone the violence, but it was encouraging to see that you had so many people, so many different races come out and say this is wrong.
And in a small window, like I for years and years, I did not give money to Vanderbilt because I was just so shocked by, you know, what I had seen and experienced there. And when I go back there now, it is so diverse. And there's such a level of mutual acceptance in something I didn't experience. And now I'm so proud of that place. And that's just a small window. I think your point about we just need to keep having these conversations. You know, I sort of stupidly thought as we got into, you know, 2000, 2010, okay, we're moving forward. This is getting better. You know, my experiences, you know, things I saw and heard reflected that. But it's pretty clear that it's not, and it's just a conversation that has to happen over and over again because there is a problem with race, and it's probably not going to go away because of the ignorance that you just referenced.
Yeah, it's very upsetting, and it's very sad. Buster Olney with us here, 98.7 ESPN. Buster, let's shift a little bit over to where we are with baseball. So we know what the owners came out with last week, players over the weekend countered, and it feels like we're miles and miles away from any kind of agreement right now.
Yeah, I think they are in terms of their respective positions. And look, you know, that can change with one phone call, with people reaching across the aisle. But as we sit here today, we still have the players saying they're not going to be open to the idea of any salary rollbacks from their prorated salaries for whatever number of games they play. And you have owners saying, we're going to need salary rollbacks. And let me tell you something. The stakes that are on the table for baseball right now are incredible. Because if there is no agreement to play baseball in 2020, and look, if they could come up with an agreement and it could all fall apart because of health concerns, coronavirus, hotspots, and that's fine. But if they don't come up with an agreement on the financial terms, this is going to spin Major League Baseball into an interminable cycle of labor issues. Because if they don't play baseball this year, if they don't have an agreement this year, that same question just gets punted to next spring, and then they have to have the same negotiation. And as I've been told by folks on the player side, you know what, next spring will be less than a year from the end of the collective bargaining agreement, the players could strike. And there might be owners who say, you know what, I've lost so much money that I'm just going to wait out the players, and I've got a bigger pile of chips than they do. And whenever they eventually work out a deal, it's going to be based on a financial model that we can work with moving forward. But here's the thing, is that all the while, the anger, the enmity of baseball and sports fans toward baseball is going to grow. The disgust is going to grow. You know, I wrote in a column over the weekend, said on Michael Kay's show the other day, this right now, it's like two second cousins arguing loudly in the back pew of a memorial service in the current context in this country. My God, they better figure it out, because it's embarrassing that this is out there and it's unresolved.
Buster Olney joins us here on the show. Buster, how much of this, in your opinion, the back and forth, you know, pretty much, you know, negotiating through the media, and how much of that has to do with the timing of this? And but what I mean by that is, because, you know, the CBA does come up after next season. Like, how much of this headed into the next CBA negotiation is involved in kind of the stalemate?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that I think especially on the owner's side that, as I mentioned, if the long game is played because they're the party sitting at the table, the larger pile of chips, and they know that negotiation's out there, and on top of that, the distrust between the two sides, the suspicion between the two sides since the last CBA in 2016, that has only grown. It absolutely frames everything that's going on right now.
Buster, I know a lot of the conversation about baseball has been about the economics of it, but looking at the latest proposal from the players, it seems like there is real concern about guys that are at high risk of being more susceptible to COVID-19. They've got this opt-out clause within that proposal. Do you have any idea about how many guys we're talking about, how many players that we're actually talking about would potentially be considering sitting out the 2020 season?
I don't know the numbers specifically. And look, there are players like Carlos Carrasco, the Cleveland Indians, who was treated for leukemia last year. David Dahl is an outfielder with the Colorado Rockies. And I think it's his spleen that was removed last year. So there are a lot of players in that situation. There might be others who have family members who have health issues. And here's something else that I think we need to remember. Because, of course, everybody could back out and cite health concerns. There is a legitimate concern on the player's side for those veteran players who are leery about playing a short season before they go into free agency. The stakes are similar to players and their decisions related to the NFL Combine or playing in bowl games, that sort of thing, because some of those guys might feel like, look, if we wind up playing an 80-game season, 60-game season, 100-game season, whatever it is, at potentially a heightened risk for injuries because the weird spring trainings that we have, is that something that I want to expose myself to? Do I want to be judged on a small sample? I've been told by agents they're going to be players. They're going to be backed out of any season because of that, no matter how they frame it publicly.
Buster Olney with us here, 98.7 ESPN. Buster, the new proposal from the players back to the owners, 114 games, which to me at this point seems like an awful lot of games.
Yep.
And starting on June 30th, today's June 1st.
Yep.
Is that remotely realistic to think that we're going to start on June 30th?
No, and Jeff Passan put it right in his story when he posted the news last night that this is a proposal that the owners are going to reject. Let's face it, I think in the owners' perfect world now, because they feel like that especially the owners who are focused on the money they're going to lose this year, as they wrote in the piece I did yesterday, there are at least six owners that I know of who are ready to blow up the season right now. I think that a lot of them feel like, look, we just need to have some kind of a baseball product regular season, whether it's 30 games or 60 games. Then we need to have the postseason. Then let's get out of Dodge before the coronavirus potentially, as we've heard from Dr. Fauci and others, might manifest itself in the fall. I think from the player's perspective, look, we want to play a number of as many games as possible so we can get paid as much as possible. Ken, as we talk about, the two sides in their various perspectives, those are so far apart, and there's so much distance between the two sides, you really do wonder how, while it makes complete sense that the two sides would agree to a deal, how do they navigate their way to the middle ground? That's the biggest question I have coming into the week. Who are the people on both sides who are going to get off the principles they've been standing on to reach a deal in the middle?
Buster, I have so many questions. I don't know if there's enough time to ask you all these questions, so I'm gonna do my best to try to ask you the most important. I think it's amazing to a lot of people that are listening to the show right now to wrap their heads around the fact that there are owners of these teams that think it's in their benefit to just shut the season down because they'll lose less money. Can you explain to them how that actually makes sense? For the six owners that you mentioned, just to not have a season, that they would actually make more money not having the season or lose less money?
Yeah, so quite literally, and not having the specifics of each team, this is a general statement. There are some owners who feel like, look, if we come back, that the potential salaries that we would have to pay might outweigh the financial gains that we would get from playing games and any television revenue that we could get. So, let's say that there's, Team X would have $80 million in payroll obligations, but on the other hand, playing games without fans in the stands, they could only draw in 30 or whatever the number is. they feel like that interest outstrips the desire to play this year. And that's been borne out, as Jeff Passan has pointed out. I think it's a great point. I mean, think about the draconian decisions that owners have been making in recent days. You have the Oakland Athletics telling their minor leaguers, we're not going to pay you $400 a week. You have the Pittsburgh Pirates ownership cutting off its 401k contributions, which, from what I understand, will save that franchise, which is worth between $1 and $2 billion, tens of thousands of dollars per month. So that gives you an idea of how focused on money, on losses, that these billionaire owners are on, or at least some of them are on.
And Buster, not to mention the hundreds of minor leagues players that were released from their contracts as well.
Just crushing. What's the number that the Oakland Athletics saved themselves $1.2 million at most by releasing all those minor leaguers, who, by the way, their baseball rights are still in the hands of the Athletics? Think about how ridiculous that is. You know, they don't have to pay them, but they're going to hold their rights.
It's crazy. Buster, I guess I got to ask you this question. How confident are you that we're going to have a baseball season this year?
I am pessimistic. I've heard from moderates on both sides, like, they have to get a deal, right? Like, they need to work it out, and they understand that, right? But again, I go back to what I said before, that it's hard to map out a path to the middle based on the respective stances that each side had. They are so far, you know, on the north and south pole, this thing. You know, how do they meet in the middle? And I'm struggling, and I know from my conversation with Jeff earlier today, he is too, trying to figure out who are going to be those people and those issues that are going to draw them together.
Buster, only with us here, 98.7 ESPN. I know you touched on it earlier during our conversation, but, I mean, the reverberations from not having a season, Buster. I mean, this is not, you don't have a season and then next year you just pick up. This is trickled down for years and years and years, I would have to imagine.
Oh, it will completely change baseball's financial landscape. You know, the union, and again, if the owners choose to play the long game and they choose to wait out, you think about it, let's say that next spring, the players, if there's not a deal, if they decide to go out on a strike, the owners sit on their pile of money, wait for change, maybe a system that has a salary cap. By the end of it, the baseball business would be enormously damaged. The union would be changed and altered, I think, in its relative power. For years, it's been the model for sports unions in America. I think that would change. I'm guessing there would be change at the top. And this is the part that I don't think the owners really have, at least some of them, have fully acknowledged how angry fans will be. I mean, think about it. 94, 95, there wasn't a pandemic. There wasn't civil unrest the way that there is right now. And baseball, when it came back after that strike, lost 20% of its attendance, and their television ratings plummeted, and it took them years to get that back. In this situation, 40 million people out of jobs, I think it could be generations of damage for baseball as a product.
Yeah, but Buster, what you just said, I would imagine that outside of those six teams, I mean, there are some pretty smart people that are involved in these conversations and know exactly what you said is the case. It almost feels like, because this is usually what owners do in these situations, is they push and push and push and try to get as many concessions from the players as possible, and then we'll eventually come to some sort of deal. That's kind of what this feels like at the moment.
I would agree with you, but I was, you know, because I'm old, I've been covering baseball for 32 years. I remember the same things being said as we got all along into the fall of 94. You know, the players went on strike on August 12th. We get into late August, we get into early September, and the conversation is, well, cooler heads will prevail, right? They'll eventually work it out, right? They won't cancel the World Series, right? And you know what? The World Series was canceled, and it happened. And because the two sides have been entrenched and, you know, based in principle to this point, I'm not completely confident that they're going to be able to get to the middle, just because I don't know how that change would take place given the respective stances they've taken.
Buster. Oh, Dave, you have one?
Yeah, I have one more, and then you can wrap
okay.
it up. You mentioned the A's. We talked about that. And there's a story yesterday that was so disturbing and disheartening to me. And it's Mark Lerner of the Washington Nationals that is reducing the amount of salary from the minor league players, and he's worth $5+ billion. And then, you know, to the credit of the players, and we don't give players a lot of credit for stuff like this, But when they do it, I think we need to. And Sean Doolittle kind of led the charge. And they're going to make up the difference as far as salary is concerned for these minor league players. But, I mean, it's just such an awful situation going on. It's such a dirty look from some of these owners.
Terrible. Absolutely terrible. The Lerners are the richest owners in baseball. Another example of what you're talking about, David Price, you know, who went to Vanderbilt, I've known him for a long time. He last week pledged that he's going to pay for the month of June $1,000 to every one of the Dodgers minor leaguers, which is tremendous. And if you know David, it's in keeping with his history of charity, and he deserves our respect for that. But as they tweeted out the other day, how embarrassing for owners that you have, you know, players who have, while David Price made a lot of money in his career, he has far less wealth than the owners do. How embarrassing is that you're talking about, you know, these billion-dollar franchises looking to save money by cutting the $400 per week salary of minor leaguers. That's embarrassing.
Yeah, but Buster, you know, and when push comes to shove, the court of public opinion, you know, fans for the most part always side with the billionaire owners, and that's the reality of it. Last one for me. So we're sitting here talking about finances and everything else. We understand that's really what it all comes down to. So if you're trying to be as safe as humanly possible, because that's a huge issue, and try to make as much money as humanly possible, why all of a sudden now are our teams, it almost feels like they're hell-bent on having the season where they're playing in their own home ballparks? Like, I don't understand why all of a sudden they got rid of the whole notion that maybe, you know, keeping, you know, half the teams in Florida was a better option.
Well, I think part of it is just the sort of the shifting numbers that we see every day. If you go to John Hopkins' website of where the hot spots are, and it might be, I'm riffing here. I think part of it is that, okay, the plan is that the Yankees and the Red Sox, Yankees and Mets would play in New York. But if hotspots pop up, then they'll move. And maybe that's to their spring training sites in Florida. If you can't do it in Florida, then maybe you move it into Texas in their new ballpark. If there are hotspots in Texas, maybe you do it someplace else. So I think that that's just a loose plan that they're very pliable about. I've been told that they built a lot of safety nets in place if a particular team can't play in a particular area.
Well, Buster, we covered a lot. As always, we appreciate it. We hope you and your family is safe and healthy and sound, and we will talk to you hopefully in the not-so-distant future.
Likewise, guys. Thank you.
This is the time that we bring him in. Andy from Merrick, wildly popular segment with his trivia questions of the day. Good morning, Andy. How are you?
Good morning, Dave. It's a tough time right now, but hopefully 5 minutes of trivia will bring a little levity to everyone.
I think it will.
And today's theme is youth is wasted on the young. We're going to start with the big man, CC.
What's up, Andy? What you got for me today?
In 2007, this defensive tackle became the youngest player in NFL history at just age 19.
Amobi Okoye.
You got it. Wow.
Yes.
Give him the bell.
Beautiful. Beautiful. So well done.
Rick, put you back on the ice. The first NHL rookie to score 40 goals and finish with 100 points in a season did it at age 18. Who was he?
Ooh. First rookie to score 100 points?
Yes, sir, and 40 goals in a season. He was just 18 years old.
18 years old.
Well, hint, he was early 80s. I think he won the 81 Calder.
Won the 81 Calder. So the year I was born, he won the Calder. 100 points, 40 goals.
I think I know who it is.
Into the 90s.
And I never, did I ever? I never played against this guy, obviously.
No, he retired by around 97.
By 97, he retired. He's a pretty long career.
I'm not sure that I know who it is. I'm thinking, did he play in Canada?
He originally played in Canada. That's correct. His first team was a Canadian-based team.
A Western Canadian-based team?
I can tell you it's Winnipeg. I don't know if Winnipeg's East
Winnipeg.
Or West.
Yeah, it's Western. Okay, I think I know who it is then.
Was he retired in 97? Was he foreign-born?
Born in Toronto, yes.
Born in Toronto. Oh, man.
Part of a huge blockbuster trade after spending about 8 years or 9 years in Winnipeg. It's traded to Buffalo.
Yeah, yeah, I know who it is. All right. Did he have the same first name as a man by the name of Carnegie?
Yes, as a matter of fact.
Yes, yes. Okay.
Yeah, that doesn't help me.
That doesn't help you?
No, that doesn't help me. I have not. Give me a better hint than that, or just answer it for me. I'm in no mood for this game right now.
I'll give you the first name, Dale.
Dale Hawerchuk.
There you go. All right, Dave, we're going to put you on the basketball court. This Laker draft pick is the youngest player ever to play in the NBA, 18 years, 6 days, when his NBA career commenced.
So he's the youngest player in NBA history?
Correct.
To play in the All-Star game?
He had one All-Star appearance, I believe.
Is he a somewhat local product?
He was a New Jersey product, yes.
Andrew Bynum.
That is correct.
There we go.
Well done,
guys.
I am
the smartest man alive!
Very well done. Very well done. All right, Andy, we appreciate it, man. Thank you, as always.
DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg. Weekdays at 10 on 98.7 ESPN.